Good morning, everybody. Welcome. Welcome both to our in-person and our online audience today. So today we're going to be hearing about the library as API from Eric Frierson. And just a couple of reminders that there are opportunities for questions during the session or at the end. Because of our online audience, please use a microphone. I can bring one around, or you can go stand at either of the mics here. And also, you can go to the program website and find a link to the evaluation for this session. I encourage everyone, please remember to do that. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Eric.
Thanks. Hey, everyone. I'm Eric. It says I'm from EBSCO Publishing, and there's a little asterisk there because when I submitted this proposal and it got accepted, I was actually the head of library systems at St. Edward's University. So this is not a vendor-sponsored session. I am putting back on my librarian hat for once, and at the risk of being chased out of this room, I will not be between you and lunch, and I will not go over, I swear. So how many library-related folk are there out there? How many non-library-related folk out there? Good, good. This is actually a really good mixture of people, because that's what the crux of this presentation is about. It's that intersection of library resources, library services, with the academy at large, using API as kind of a framework to think about library services and what we do. Currently, I really enjoyed yesterday's opening session about the geeks and non-geeks in communication, because my current job is as a sales engineer for EBSCO Publishing, which means, you know, I'm one of the geeks who sits back and does, you know, PHP, Ruby on Rails coding, but then I get to go out and talk to librarians, talk to people on campus about how their students use libraries, and it's my job to kind of be the bridge between the deep back end of our products but the on-the-ground working librarian who uses our products and the students that that they work with on campus. So it's a really fun job, and if you do like that kind of geek, non-geek thing, I'll pitch the sales engineer track to you because it's a lot of fun. Okay, so I think before I dive into what I mean by library as API, I kind of want to talk a little bit about why I thought this was somewhat of a relevant topic by looking at the current landscape of library services. So this is, again, a little activity. Librarians, for some reason, like this think and share kind of activity. So we're going to do a little bit of one. And I'd like you to maybe, on the left side of the room, I'll go ahead and do the same division. So that's left, right? Okay, that's left. So left side of the room, I'd like you to take a look at this first scenario. So if you were a student who has to do a research assignment, you've been given this assignment sheet by a professor, and the assignment says you need at least 10 academic resources to back up your arguments. I want you to think step by step, what would a student have to do in order to accomplish that from the moment they're in class and they get this assignment sheet that says find 10 academic journal articles? What are the things at your institution might that student have to do? Where would they have to go? What sites would they have to look at? I'm only going to give you maybe about 2 minutes for this. The other side of the room, I want you to think like a faculty member, all right? Your faculty member is setting up their class site at the beginning of a semester, you know, not 2 days before the class semester begins, obviously, but well in advance. They're setting up their course website, and they want to put together a list of readings for their students to interact with. And they'd like to use some library resources in there. I'd like you to think about the step-by-step things that they would have to do to get, let's say, a few articles that are in the library's collection into their course website. All right, so hopefully someone around you has that kind of experience. I think we're small enough that everyone can just talk to everyone. But for 2 minutes, just think about the step-by-step process that someone at your institution would have to do to accomplish these tasks. Just maybe about 30 more seconds. All right, at the risk of cutting off some very good points, I'm going to pull us back together. Student group, what did you do to conduct your research to try to find these 10 things? What are the steps that you took? I heard a couple of things that that you were saying as you were talking, but would someone from the group like to offer up what you did, hopefully with a microphone in hand?
Google.
So you go to Google.
We're
you
students,
do
right?
Your search.
And okay. You're from the classroom, actually.
And you did it while you were in the classroom on your mobile device.
Right.
Okay. In the classroom. Did any of you actually end up at the library? All right. So you ended up, how did you go about doing that part?
Well, I would advise students to go to the library link from their course page, mm-hmm. and they have a one search feature, and that's about as far as I could direct them at that point.
Okay.
As to databases, you know, no specifics there.
Sure. So there's a course management system. You have a link that pumps them into a library website where there's a search box that they can then go about doing their business.
Yes.
Okay. All right, let's go over to the faculty side. Faculty putting together a reading list that they want to include in their course management system. Tell me about that experience. I think there's a mic on the table there over there, too.
So to do this at our institution, the faculty members would have to go to the library website. They'd have to find the databases, log in to a proxy server if they are off campus, find the article, and either download that article as a PDF or find the link, or the way they can get a permanent link to that article, and then go back into the CMS and figure out how to embed that. So, kind of cumbersome.
About the same for the rest of the people at the table? Different. Would you mind sharing?
In all honesty, they could do one of two things from the classroom. They could punch the button in the LMS that says ask a librarian,
mm-hmm.
and they'll get a live librarian ready to help them,
uh-huh.
who, if as a faculty member I had pre-briefed on the expectations for the course, would have a whole bunch of resources ready for them.
Okay.
Or they could look in the resource section of the LMS for that lesson and come up with a list and usually direct search from there into the library holdings.
Great. So in order to create that document, they probably have to do something similar to finding all of those permalinks to construct that document, too. I think one thing that we're hearing similar, all right, well, there's one thing that's very different about the going to Google first. In that scenario, they bypass the library altogether, right, because it's not in their kind of normal workflow. I think everybody, by the time they hit college, they're comfortable with Google. It becomes one of these habits that, I don't know, I do it too whenever I sit down at a computer. My fingers kind of just automatically type Google without me even needing to Google anything. So that's kind of a normal workflow, and sometimes the library gets bypassed if they don't understand what the library is for, what the library does, because it's outside of their normal realm. In the other situations, you have to go to a library website and you have to construct some kind of search. And in the scenario that you painted, Jennifer, is that right? In the scenario that you painted, Jennifer, I don't know, how many steps were there, like 9 or 10 that it required? And if you wanted to put together a document that students could download, then it's still a matter of getting over to the library website, knowing which databases to search. Now, given faculty probably know which databases they want to search because they're researchers in that field. However, finding the permalink is actually kind of a challenge in a lot of these different databases. Because you can't just copy the URL that's at the top of the screen, because then that's going to break whenever you actually share it with students. All right? All of this just to say it's kind of a muddled experience using the library, whether it's completely outside of the normal path of a student doing research, or whether it's something that they want to do, and even if they know how to do it, it could be up to a 10, 12-step process just to pull one link to one article to include in a course management system. All right. I think someone mentioned that in some cases there are databases within the library that you might have to select from if you don't have a single search box. I'm trying to paint, with your help, the library as a silo with silos among other silos on campus. We've got the course management system over here that students interact with, hopefully on a daily basis, to interact with their course content. They have the in-person experience in the classroom or in whatever, you know, they're doing there. They have their email system. They have the library is sitting over here. They have academic success on campus that they can go to for help. On occasion, there'll be a writing center on campus that they can go to help. The academic experience is one with a lot of different silos. Some have found ways to kind of tie these silos together with a link in the course management system to the library, but it's still a completely different experience when you're linked out to the library and you conduct your search over there. All right. In addition, in the library, well, I'll just show you an example of this is actually a leading research library's homepage. All right, and it's not unlike what you would see at most libraries around the country. All right, here. Anyone want to take a quick count at how many different ways there are to conduct a search on this page? Right. I'll just count out loud with you guys. So right now it looks like books is highlighted on the left, so I've got five separate options and buttons to search for books, except I also have that drop-down that says keyword, so there are a few other ways I could tweak my search before I type something in and hit go. And that's just the books tab. There's also the Articles tab, the Journals tab, the E-Resources tab, News, Archives, Manuscripts, Images, Dissertations, and at the top there's Catalog as well. All right. I redacted the name of the library. I'm not sure why, because all libraries are not much different than this, to be honest with you. But there are, goodness, if any of the other tabs are similar to this tab, there's on order of, I don't know, 25 or 30 different ways to do a search on this page. And you haven't even gone into individual databases yet. There are a bunch of different services over there on the right-hand side. All right? So there are a lot of silos within the library experience itself. So if we're lucky enough to have students that actually get to the library before heading straight to Google, all right, we've got this kind of experience within the library that's full of silos. All right? So there are an awful lot of rich resources. I don't think anyone would argue that there are lots of rich resources within the library once you get there and once you start using them. Being able to provide a link to an academic article that would really grow their knowledge in a particular topic area, invaluable. Lots of rich stuff in the library. There's getting started reference materials. I think someone showed earlier in the comic where, you know, Gale Virtual Reference Library provides these kinds of getting started, things to jumpstart you on your research when maybe an academic journal article may not be the best thing for your sense-making experience at that moment. So not only do we have those heavy-hitting research articles, but we have things that students could use to kind of ramp up their research as they go along. We've got the actual research librarians there, the people that you can ping who you know will be helpful, who you know will serve, you know, serve students along this kind of research journey. A lot of times there's writing assistance and technology help within the library. So I'm not arguing that there's not great stuff in the library. The experience of using it, though, is somewhat perplexing in a world where everything just seems to work together already. Why are there these separate different places I have to go to do to get value out of some of these things? There are literally, in some institutions, millions of dollars tied up in these really good resources that are often behind a few silos and a few layers that make it a little bit confusing for, let's say, you know, a freshman to get access to. All right. So I just love this picture, so I figured I'd build in an analogy. So there's really rich treasures in the library that, you know, no matter how much we go out there, and someone said they hate marketing, you know, I hate having to go out and market the library. I hate having to say the library is full of these rich and wonderful things. And we have to do that because it's not an obvious step in a lot of situations for students. It's not always obvious at the libraries where they go to get this kind of service and this kind of materials. A lot of times they think Google because that's where they've been able to satisfy their information needs in the past. So the goal of this is, how do we attempt take those rich resources that our libraries already offer, all those wonderful things that we already do, and work them and break them free of the silo. There are some attempts already at de-siloing the library experience, you know, with mixed results. I'm not going to give you the history of federated searching and unified searching in libraries, but at this point, I think the standard where we're at in terms of trying to de-silo within the library lives in something called discovery systems. Not every library has one yet, but several libraries do, and here's just a list of different discovery systems that are out there. What a discovery system does is it gathers things like PsycInfo and ERIC and Education Index and all of these disparate databases, tries to put them into one index so that there is one search box that someone can type in and be searching across these different databases. I think state of the art 4 or 5 years ago was pretty paltry. You would have to type something in and wait about 2 minutes, and you'd see these different results coming in from different databases, and by the time that a student has waited 5 seconds to get results, they're already gone somewhere else. So the difference between where discovery services are now, the things that you see here, is we pre-compile all of that stuff into one big index so the results can be delivered almost instantly. Now, there are drawbacks to this. I think any of these discovery service vendors will tell you, we cover most of what you have. There's not going to be a single discovery service that covers everything, mostly because of competition between these different companies. So it's difficult to pitch a service that does everything all at once because it's not going to. But it does satisfy a lot of different kinds of questions. And I say satisfies is meaning it gets you enough. And I know that's kind of repulsive to some people, the sound of good enough. And I did a presentation a couple of months ago called The Difference Between Pragmatic Librarians and Idealist Librarians. I'm not going to go into that here. But I know there is controversy surrounding discovery services. Right? That's not the point of this talk. Right? The point of this talk is there are some attempts to try to simplify the experience for students by de-siloing things, by not making these arcane paths to these rich resources, trying to bring that valuable content to the forefront. All right? So something like a discovery service would allow a library to do something like this, where there is a giant search box, you type something in, and you're searching through articles, books, videos, movies, DVDs, you know, pretty much anything that the library has, this will search through, all right, and then provide you with, you know, one-click access, hopefully, to those resources. And, you know, for a student who's used to kind of getting that instant gratification of, I type in a search word, I click on a link, I'm looking at the thing, as they do with Google, you know, these discovery services are an attempt at replicating that experience or that meeting that expectation while still providing the higher quality resources that are there. I'm really tempted to go into a sales pitch right now. I'm not going to. And yet, we haven't solved the problem of the library as a silo in the institution. Discovery services are an attempt to de-silo inside the library, but still, even if we have a one search box on our homepage, the fact is they have to know to go to the library to use that search box, or know that that link in the CMS that says library is the thing that they would use to get at those rich full-text resources, that kind of thing. And a lot of times, even if there's a link that says library, the concept of what I can do with the library or what I can do at the library is a fuzzy one to a lot of undergraduate students. I think we have tried some initial attempts, and some of these attempts are very old, but they're still there. I think RSS was an initial attempt at trying to get library content out of the library website or making a special trip to the library to do library-related things. How many of you are familiar with RSS readers and things like that? At EDUCAUSE, it's probably not a foreign topic, but it's a way for people to go if they did do a search in one of our databases. There's probably a place that says, save this as an RSS alert, and then from then on out, if a faculty member normally goes to their RSS reader to gather the news on the day, they might see new results that match their search in that database. So they no longer have to make a special trip, rerun their search, to see if there's anything new in their field or new in the topics that they're interested in. Now, there were problems with RSS in the sense that it wasn't terribly widely adopted. I wouldn't think your average faculty member subscribes to an RSS feed. I wouldn't say the average human being subscribes to an RSS feed, all right? It's not a terribly difficult setup, especially for geeks, but for non-geeks, it's you know, kind of a thing. You have to know, okay, what is RSS, this acronym that you've never heard before? And then you have to sign up with an RSS service, and then it becomes kind of a morass. You don't really want to dive into something that complicated. So even this initial attempt, while it worked, you know, if the normal workflow of Professor X was to check their RSS feeds from different places and boom, there's a library result there, successful. I didn't have to make a special trip to the library to learn that there's a new publication on my topic right here. It works. Problem is, it's still over here in this RSS silo now. So I think, though, that what the RSS experiment did for us is it caused us to start thinking not about, and I think this was mentioned yesterday, geeks tend to think in what the stereotypical geek tends to think of, here's the product, why don't you learn how to use it? Whereas the non-geeks say, here's what I do, why can't the product do what I want it to? And I think it's this shift that libraries have started to make, and RSS, I think, was one of the initial attempts. Okay, what do people do to find information? How can we become part of that workflow rather than saying, you must use the library's website and the library's tools to get what you need done? So I think this helped us shift to thinking about not what we do and what we provide, but where can we provide it? When are we needed? How are we going to get this done? And I think that last question is the thing that libraries tend to struggle with most because of the way that we've traditionally been staffed. You know, a lot of libraries may have, big libraries will have whole units that operate their own IT shop. And if you're one of these places, I know that in some of these places, the library IT clashes with campus IT on a regular basis. I see some nods out there. You know, I've been at various institutions where sometimes that partnership is beautiful, and sometimes, oh, you have your own servers with your own security policies on your own computers in the library. That's different from our campus policies and our campus security. Sometimes that can cause friction. So sometimes the how of this becomes difficult because it's all on the library to do, or there's a strained relationship between librarians and the geeks who could probably figure out how to do some of these ideas that we have. We have ideas of, well, the course management system is where a lot of the work of academia happens, all right? There are students and our faculty are at Moodle. That's where they're interacting, especially in online programs. But how do we actually make something that seamlessly fits into those environments, all right? And that's what this session really is about. So I believe the tools are APIs. Briefly, how many of you have ever worked with an API? You've done coding. Let's say you've done coding against an API. All right, good, because this is not a coding session, all right? How many of you know kind of what APIs do in general? All right, good, a few handfuls, all right? So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So essentially what an API is let's say you have these two separate web-based applications. You have Blackboard, all right, as an example, CMS. On the right, you'll have EBSCO Discovery Service. Two separate things, they don't interact with each other, they're provided by two different companies, and they don't really do anything with one another, all right? In a sense, an API allows the application on the left to write special modules or special code that takes advantage of some of the content on the right or some of the tools on the right. All right. So if EBSCO Discovery Service said, I have an API, and we got in touch with the Blackboard folks and say, look, we have this API. You can actually do stuff with EDS content, EDS being the tool on the right. You can do stuff with EDS content. You can do stuff with our search engine, our search algorithm within the Blackboard experience. That would be possible because of an API. It allows these two programs, Blackboard and EDS, to talk to each other, to interact in deep ways. Right? As an example, this is something that I just finished coding about a week ago, Project Blacklight. It's something that some libraries have decided to use to lay on top of their catalog. They don't like the way their catalog looks. They don't like the fact that it won't let you search in certain ways, so they use Blacklight and toss their catalog records in there. All right? Blacklight as a standalone application has nothing to do with journal articles. It's just your catalog records that get loaded into this thing. So using our API with EBSCO Discovery Service, I augmented that tool such that you can pull in all of the results you'd normally see on this third-party library site right into the experience that they already had. So an API is a way to eliminate kind of different silos around and build one resource that kind of can tackle these rich different these kind of different kind of applications. So, for instance, this catalog is no longer just the books that the library has. It's one experience where they can bookmark various journal articles and bookmark various books they want to use, see their search history, log in using university authentication instead of some third-party authentication site. APIs allow you to build rich experiences with the tools you already have. So I'd like us to envision a little bit a reading list tool to kind of eliminate at least 12 of the steps of this 19-step process of creating a reading list. All right. So let's imagine we have access to this massive amount of peer-reviewed articles, research articles from EBSCO Discovery Service. And we've got this course management system. We know faculty members go in, they set up their course, and in order to add a library resource, they have to leave the course building experience and go over to the library website, do a search, find an article, either download it or get the permalink, and then come back to the course building experience and upload it into their CMS. All right? I'd like to figure out a way we can best stay within the actual workflow of creating class. Why kick them over to the library? All right. Luckily, most CMSs like Blackboard, Moodle, Desire to Learn subscribe to something called the LTI protocol. The slides are on the session, so if you want to follow this link, you can. Essentially, it's a mini API that Blackboard has and these other CMSs have that will pass along to a third application the name of the student, what role they have in the class, or the name of the professor. Some information that would be useful to a third-party site. So here I've got Eric's awesome reading list website. I've created a new website, and whenever you click on the link in Blackboard that takes you to it, it shows up as embedded within the Blackboard. You're not being kicked out to some external site. And it looks like it's part of the Blackboard experience. So from a visual perspective, it's seamless. You just see this new tool load up in here. What's nice is that website now knows, whenever it loads, it knows, oh, this is Professor X, coming from the History of Art 101, all right? And I know that they have the role of instructor, all right? And I know that it's for spring of 2013, all right? It knows all this information because Blackboard is passing that right to this application via something called the LTI protocol. So now I'm running this website that knows an awful lot about who's logging into it at any given moment. So what I can do for that person is, oh, you're a professor for this class in spring of 2007. Well, let me give you a little search box here that you can type in with, again, without having left the Blackboard experience. You type in what you want to find to add to your reading list. I'll show you results, and with one click, you can click on Add to Reading List, Add to Reading List, Add to Reading List. And because I know what class you're coming from, I know it's the spring, it's section 001 of History of Art 101 from spring of 2013. Because I know this, I'll store it right here specifically for your class. All right? Later that day, all right? And whenever you do type in something to search, I'm going over to EBSCO Discovery Service and pulling back all of the library's resources to display, and that's what you have to select from. So whenever the student comes in to this, it says, oh, well, you're a student. You're in History of Art 101, Section 001 from spring 2013. Because you're a student, I'm not going to give you this search box that allows you to add things to the reading list. But because I know who you are and what you're trying to do and where you're coming from, I'm just going to show you a list of the things that your professor has already marked. And each of those comes with full text links that's drawing from the library's resources via that API. So in a way, the experience now becomes, I'm faculty member, I'm setting up my course, I create a new tool reading list, search for what I want, that one, that one, that one, done. Student comes in, they click on that exact same link, now they're seeing those three or four or five or 10 different things that the professor added to the reading list. I mean, it's a pretty powerful change from having to get kicked out to the library website, having to do a lot of your own kind of downloading, figuring out permalinks, navigating proxy servers, that kind of thing, and then coming back and having to navigate the upload process. Right? Probably save a lot of time on behalf of the faculty member and create a nifty tool that a library can provide. Of course, you want to brand it your library so it doesn't look like this is a Blackboard feature because it is drawing from the rich resources that the library provides. So that's an idea of what could happen. In fact, I've actually built the EDS, the EBSCO Discovery Service, end of it. So right now I'm actually looking for partners who want to partner on the Blackboard end of it, or the Moodle end of it, or the desire to learn end of it, to see if we can't build something like this over the next semester. So my last slide is an invitation to partner with people who want to interact. So here's something that it might look like. Let's say this is a Blackboard instance right here. You have an add to reading list. This is a terrible wireframe that I just threw together. But you could, you know, click on those add to reading list buttons, and when the student goes to see it, they'll just see the list of things that you had. You have video recordings, ebooks, print books that are in the library, that kind of thing. And again, this probably took maybe, in our hypothetical situation, a minute or two for the professor to build, as opposed to having to go out to each of these different sites. So libraries actually have a ton of APIs. Discovery services, I think almost all of them have an API of some kind you can tap into. So whether you're a subscriber to EBSCO Discovery Service like we saw, or you're a subscriber to ProQuest Summon, or Ex Libris Prima, or one of these other ones, I know for a fact that at least those top two, the top three leading ones have APIs that you can tap into. That kind of thing is there. LibAnswers is a popular service for libraries to provide FAQs and a knowledge base for library-related questions. That has an API. You can pull all of that knowledge base into different places. So, for example, on your OneSearch library box, you could actually start typing interlibrary loan, and what might the librarians here will know what will happen when you type in interlibrary loan into a search box. So you're anticipating figuring out how to borrow a book from a distant library, but instead you're kicked to a bunch of journal articles about interlibrary loan services. So with an API, you could actually pull LibAnswers library FAQ content into the search experience. So there are ways to clean up some of these problems that I think we have in libraries using API. A lot of ILSs, which is usually the software that manages the library from its acquisitions to paying invoices to checking out books to maintaining a list of, maintaining the inventory of the library, a lot of them have APIs as well. So if you're creating a student portal or a student dashboard on your campus, you could pull in to not only will your students' email there be there, your students' registrar information be there, but also what library finds they have and what books they have checked out. Heck, with the Discovery Service APIs, you can even have My Marked Items. So you can see the items you've marked from your library searching right there in kind of a campus portal dashboard. So in this way, libraries can contribute value to a unified student dashboard in a sense. The last one is something I'm really excited about and I think has a lot of potential, is generating some statistics, some quantitative numbers on library use that could then be correlated to student academic achievement. This is something that's brewing that I think might be a total mind mess if I go into it. But imagine that we could actually see that, you know, anonymized data, of course, that student X downloaded 100 full text articles from the library, and student X got a GPA of 3.98, matriculated all 4 years to the university. Those kind of metrics that I think are valuable in institutions of higher education. And we could say that student Y, well, they only downloaded one or two, and those were newspaper articles. And they dropped out after their junior year with a GPA of 1.5. I don't know that that would happen. I'm hoping that would happen. I'm hoping library usage actually promotes learning. But I think in the library field, we struggled with this. We struggled, how do we tie academic achievement to library use? And I think we've got some measures out there, but nothing solidly quantitative. And I think this might be an avenue to start tracking this kind of data to figure out what our impact on academic achievement is. And that's kind of scary. And of course, there are privacy issues and things like that with collecting student data. But I think we could probably overcome those with some level of anonymizing the data and correlating it. So I'm running towards the end of my time here. And I think there are some discussion questions, no matter what role you fill on campus, whether you're a librarian, you're in IT, that might help start sparking these kinds of ideas. They are in the slides if you want to take a look at it. But I think one of the top questions that a library should ask itself is, when are we beneficial in the student and faculty experience? Is it during orientation, or is it during their first research project when they've gotten their assignment and they're actually sitting down to do research? When are those moments that the library is most useful? And how can we use different tools to get ourselves as close to that moment of need as possible? All right. A lot of us in libraries build things called libguides and research guides and these kinds of things. And unfortunately, I think, you know, those are some extremely valuable resources that are probably one of the most siloed things that we have on campus. They sit in the separate link on the library website, completely out of the research experience in a lot of cases. So how can we, knowing that we have this rich resource out there, when would our students need it the most? Perhaps it's when they get zero results in a search, or maybe when they get 100,000 results in a search. Maybe that's when it's a good idea to say, hey, it looks like you got zero results. Maybe we could connect you with a librarian or a research guide in your subject area. It's trying to find the when. What tools do you have at your disposal? I listed a few, LibAnswers and ILSs that have APIs, that's Go Discovery Service that has an API. Chances are, you know, the things that your library subscribes to, those different tools that you have, might have an API. Perhaps that may be something you should evaluate tools as you're evaluating whether or not to purchase this solution for your library. Maybe one of the questions should be, does it have an API we could use? So it's not just this standalone silo. One of the big questions I have is, do libraries need to employ programmers? I happen to be a programmer. I was employed at a library, and I got to do this kind of stuff. But, you know, I haven't looked at the statistics, but I imagine it's more rare to have a programmer in a library. So I guess one of the questions you would need to ask on campus is, how are we going to possibly do this? What kind of partnerships need to be in place to actually make something like this happen? I'll leave these up here, but again, the last thing I wanted to touch on is an invitation. As I said, I you should take a look at your library's website, and if you see an EBSCO logo somewhere and it's a single search box, chances are your library has EBSCO Discovery Service. All right, and if you have Moodle or Desire to Learn or Blackboard or any of the CMSs and you're interested in building this reading list tool, I've got something ready to roll that I can partner with you in trying to develop something. As I mentioned, my job is half working with people and half working with code. So I kind of enjoy being that liaison to building something exciting and new. So that's what I got. I've got my photo credits on there, of course, that you can click and see through some of that stuff. It's a CC license stuff. But that's what I got for you. Again, I'm at risk of losing my geek status by pitching these things that are not concrete and not right there. You know, that I can do bullet, here's what you do one, here's what you do two, here's what you do three. But that's a risk I think I'm willing to take. All right. So any questions and comments?
So I was just wondering, with the reading list tool, is that something that you envision replacing electronic reserves, or is it something that just augments electronic reserves? Because I imagine everybody's already got those in place right now, at least at my library. What we're doing is there's still a person that's the intermediary, although that seems to be the way faculty want it now because it's complicated to use the online form. So is this something that would eventually integrate into that so that you can get rid of goofy forms where you have to fill out citations and stuff like that?
I would love to get rid of goofy forms. The first thing that actually sprung to mind as you were asking your question is there an API for your course reserve system? Because a lot of times, you know, there are established workflows that you may not want to disrupt. But I think there, you know, I do think the idea is, how do we provide high quality service in as streamlined as way as possible? And if that means rethinking how electronic reserves are done, how it interacts with a discovery service API, for example, I think that's something that, I think this will also be a hard look at, you know, what and how we do it at libraries. Is there a better way? And I think that can be challenging in the case of established, you know, protocol, established methods. That was a very weird way to answer the question. Yes. There.
One question from the online audience, more of a conceptual one. I've heard that librarians like to search for things, whereas patrons like to find things. Mm-hmm. Any comments?
Well, I think, I may have alluded to this a little bit earlier when I said the expectation is, you know, I type in something in Google. If I click on a link, I'm expecting to be reading it, not reading about it. I think that's kind of, libraries, I think, like that kind of experience where you see metadata. Metadata is a glorious thing for quite a few of us. But I'm pretty sure that most of our users don't care. They want to just find what they're looking for. And I think discovery services enable that. And then I kind of point back to the library as a staff. I think we're, the profession has kind of a schism in the middle of it. You've got one half that there's a great chapter right there. I should put it in the slides, where they're called idealist librarians. They believe that whenever you come to an institution, the goal of the institution is to teach people to be those comprehensive researchers, to know the databases, to know how to go in and do subject searching. And you've got, I would say, a clean 50% of librarians that believe that. And then you've got the pragmatist librarians who kind of address, I want to help my users find things. I don't want to help them construct these careful searches and these dive into these individual databases. I want them to be able to accomplish the goals that they have in as little time as possible. And that's the other camp of libraries that tends to build sites with single search boxes and subscribe to discovery services. And I think that's a conversation that every library is going to have before they decide what direction they're going to go. And I can tell you, it's pretty difficult to be at an institution where there's enough people on both sides of the camp to cause strife. I think there are ways that you can accommodate both. There are ways in a discovery system to funnel people to more advanced searching if that's one of your library's goals. So maybe that's the answer. Yeah, maybe the choice is enable finding by de-siloing, but then provide avenues to these deeper research tools within that experience. Okay. Uh-huh. There is lunch, so if you do want to skedaddle, I completely understand.
Time for one more, I think.
Yeah.
My question is, non-geek here. So some of our silos, many of our silos, have different authentication methods, mm-hmm. and our library databases have one password, which mm-hmm. does a few other things, and our Blackboard system has a different mm-hmm. password. So can that be handled?
I think so. The API, let me go back a couple of slides real quick. So this thing that you see here at the bottom, that taps into an LDAP protocol. I know you could configure it to tap into an Active Directory authentication protocol. It can go via EasyProxy to accept a username or something like that. So while an API won't solve your entire campus's authentication system, I think if your campus can agree upon an authentication system, then an API could probably leverage it to authenticate users. So I don't think it can do the authentication. But I'm pretty sure whatever API you use can tap into whatever authentication system you use on campus. I know that's probably one of the most frustrating things for students at the end of the semester who come. My product, right, EBSCO Discovery Service, there's a My Folders login. That's a completely separate login than your campus authentication system. So a lot of times students will be off campus, they'll log in through campus authentication to get to EBSCO Discovery Service, they'll do a search, they'll add things to the folder, and they'll close their window. And then they'll come back and say, where's my stuff? I logged in. What are you talking about? Did I log in? Yes, I logged in. But because of this dual authentication system, that's a point of confusion. All right. Yes. I'll tell you that now. In the June or July, I don't know if any of your EBSCO host subscribers of any kind, but those problems are going to be solved with a single sign-on plugin for EBSCO that can tap into other things. So we might see that problem slowly going away, whether or not you use the API. All right. Now, if you use the API, you can of course build your own authentication system into it.
We're going to have to call it.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.